Greetings, everyone, and good afternoon or good morning, depending on where you're joining with us from today. My name is Robin Jones, and I am going to be helping with the moderation duties today. I want to welcome everyone to the Accessibility Online webinar series today on February 2nd, Groundhog's Day. I'm from Chicago, so we know that we have at least 6 more weeks of winter, so I guess we're all just braced for what has to come forward. Just going to cover a few of the features of the webinar system for those of you that might be new to our program before we get started. Closed captioning is available. You've heard me make a few announcements about that during the sound checks. You can click the CC icon at the top of your screen or using the keyboard Control F8. That will open up the dialog box, which you then can adjust the captioning screen as needed to meet your own individual needs. For those of you that might want to change your view a little bit and maybe make your viewing screen larger for the slides or whatever, you can do that by going up to the View option at the top of your screen. It's a drop-down menu. You'll get several options of different types of layouts that are available that you can choose, and you're free to play around with those. It only affects your view, nobody else's. You can also unlock your current layout, and that makes all of the boxes resizable to your own individual customized preference as well. So if you're interested in doing that, do that anytime. We will be taking questions today. Many of you did submit questions in advance for which our speakers will be addressing throughout the webinar itself, but we encourage you to submit questions. You will not see the questions as they are entered. They're hidden from you, but they will be viewable by the actual presenters themselves, and they will be addressing those questions as the time permits on a first-come, first-served basis. So again, we encourage you to go ahead, just type into the chat area. For those of you that are using a keyboard, Control M will get you into the chat area. Many of you are familiar with the options available in webinar programs to do smiley faces, raise your hand, clap your hands, etc. We do ask you to refrain from using those features during the session unless you're directed to do so by the presenter. We find that they can be distracting for other participants, so thank you very much for that. And without further ado, I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Erlene Sesker from the U.S. Access Board, who will be assisting with today's program. Erlene, go ahead.
Good afternoon. I, too, would like to welcome and thank everyone for joining us today at the Accessible Courthouse and Courtrooms webinar. Dave Yanchulis will be our presenter today. Dave has served as an accessibility specialist at the Access Board for over 20 years and regularly provides technical assistance and training to the public on accessible design and the board's accessibility guidelines for buildings and facilities. He was involved in the development and update of the board's ADA and ABA accessibility guidelines, including sections covering judicial facilities and courthouses. Dave also serves as the board's coordinator of public affairs and oversees various outreach activities, including publication of his newsletter, Access Currents. I will now turn the presentation over to Dave. Thank you.
Thank you, Erlene, and thank you, everybody, for joining us today. By the time we end today, hopefully, you'll have a better understanding of the accessibility requirements for courthouses and courtrooms. Now, today's session, we're going to cover a lot of the issues that come up in the design of courthouses, focusing on areas including entrances, courtrooms, and raised stations within them, and holding cells. And we're going to wrap up with briefly touching on some other spaces within courthouses where we get questions. And then we're going to end the session with a Q&A time, so any questions that come in, get submitted, we will try and address those before ending today. Slide 5. Now, the basis for the presentation today are the requirements found in the new ADA standards. They were published in 2010 by the Department of Justice, and they become mandatory this March, March 15th. That effective date applies to the start of projects, the start of construction or alteration in the case of state and local government facilities. And so we'll be talking about provisions in these standards as they pertain to courthouses. Now, many of you may know that these standards derive from the board's guidelines issued under the ADA and the Architectural Barriers Act that go back to 2004. So if you've become familiar with those guidelines, you certainly have a good leg up on what's in the actual standards, because the standards are very much consistent with those guidelines, and so they're very similar. Now, the standards speak to new construction and alterations. A lot of people, when they ask about courthouses or have questions or concerns, oftentimes it's in relation to an existing facility, one that may have predated the ADA of 1990, even some that are historic. And the standards and how they address access will inform ways to go about improving access in older historic facilities, but you often may have to contend with certain other constraints. And the bulk of our discussion today is going to focus on requirements as they apply when you're building new or when you're altering. Under the ADA, when we're talking about existing facilities, including those that are historic, state and local government entities really have to rely on their obligation to provide access to programs and services. And what that means is that there may be some solutions that are viable in that context that we would not permit in new construction or alteration, where the expectations are greater that you're going to fully comply architecturally. So for example, in an older courthouse where maybe it's problematic achieving access to some courtrooms on an upper level, the program access obligation for existing facilities might allow one to pursue alternatives as focusing on ground floor accessible courtrooms that are more easily retrofitted for access than some other ones, and have the courtroom assignment and logistics be addressed so that access is achieved. But in new construction alterations, it's really the scope of work and the project that's driving a fuller level of compliance. But we will touch on some issues pertaining to historic along the way, but most of what we're pointing out here are requirements that apply when you're building new or altering. Slide 6. Now, the ADA standards apply to state and local government facilities and courthouses. There are very similar standards issued under the Architectural Barriers Act for federal facilities, including federal courthouses. The Architectural Barriers Act predates the ADA, and it was really the first effort by Congress to address access to the built environment, but it is limited to the federal sector and to buildings built with federal money. But the ADA standards and the ABA standards in their current form are very, very similar, probably pretty much 99% identical. But there are some differences, not too many of which are really pertinent to the sections on courthouses. Slide 7. Now, the sections we're going to be touching on today in the ADA and ABA standards concern accessible routes, scoping for judicial facilities, and particularly courtrooms, which is in Section 231. There's also the technical chapter on courtrooms found in Chapter 8, Section 808, as well as Section 807, which covers holding cells. Now, with the latest standards, what we've tried to do is make coverage of different types of occupancies more integrated into the whole document. And that's why when you look at these standards in the Chapter 8 for special rooms and spaces, you see that the unique provisions for those spaces are pretty limited, because the rest of the document applies as well. And a lot of things we'll be touching on today lie outside some of these sections. For example, when we talk about entrances and doors, we're actually talking about areas outside the special section on courtrooms. And so on a lot of these slides, you'll see the pertinent section number just to kind of indicate where in the document you could look up the provisions. Slide 8. Now, one general point about courthouse accessibility is that it's too often treated as an afterthought. And that leads to a lot of problems. Many people report issues with access at courthouse, even ones that are relatively new. And a big part of the problem is that accessibility isn't integrated into the design process at all stages, from the very beginning, initial concept, all the way through to mock-ups, which are typically done as part of the design of courthouses and courtrooms. If accessibility is brought in and addressed and understood at the beginning and pretty much baked into the process, it really does eliminate a lot of issues, a lot of oversights, a lot of errors. So that's one major way to go about improving access to courthouse is to make sure that the process is working toward that end as well. What we found too is that the requirements for accessibility in the standards for courthouses are achievable without compromising or impacting security, sight lines within the courtroom, and other aspects of traditional courtroom design. So there really aren't many conflicts that would complicate compliance for accessibility purposes. Slide 9. Now, the Access Board did look more closely into issues concerning accessibility to courthouses, realizing that a lot of problems were being reported, a lot of access barriers still being present. And as part of that effort, the board organized an advisory committee back in 2004 to specifically look into these issues and to develop guidance on how courthouse access could be improved and design improved so that these issues could be avoided. This committee represented many different types of stakeholders. We had judges on the committee, courthouse operators, courthouse designers and architects, disability groups, and others. And they looked at a lot of these issues, actually toured various courthouses throughout the country, and developed a report of recommendations for the board. Next slide. And the report from the committee, which was actually issued in 2006, is available on the board's website. What it does is it provides guidance on how to meet the standards, and they looked ahead working from the board's guidelines. So their recommendations are consistent with what's in the current 2010 ADA standards. So looking at this report, you'll get a better understanding of how to meet the standards. You'll also learn about best practices that actually go beyond the minimum required by the standards and improve access even more. And they also discussed and addressed common errors found in terms of courthouse accessibility. Again, that report is available on the board's website at www.access-board.gov/CAAC. And in the presentation today, I'll be drawing on this report and including some of the recommendations and best practices developed by this committee. Slide 10. We're going to start off today in looking at courthouses by examining issues of access at entrances. Slide 12. Now, entrances in the new standards must be accessible according to the scoping provisions. These are found in Section 206.4. The standards require that 60% minimum of public entrances be accessible. In addition to that 60%, you also have to provide access to any dedicated entrances serving parking structures or elevated walkways or pedestrian tunnels. In addition to that you must also make sure that access is provided to at least one restricted entrance where provided. In a courthouse, you may have entrances that are limited to certain employees, and where use of the entrance is controlled, that would be considered a restricted entrance. So at least one of those where provided must be accessible. And we also require that at least one entrance where provided serving inmates or detainees that is secured be accessible as well. Slide 13. Now, entrances, in terms of best practices, we found that if you minimize the elevation of the entry level and avoid plinths or raised platforms, greatly facilitates access. It's been a tradition in the past with courthouse design to have an elevated level of entry, usually to make the building appear more majestic and formal. But we found that there's a lot of ways to achieve what's required without raising the entry level. Some argue that it also helps with security, but bollards, so long as they don't intrude on accessible routes, planters, a deeper setback from streets, are other strategies that can be used in lieu of having a raised entry level and a lot of steps. It's also very good practice to make sure that in providing access to entrances, you include the primary entrance. There isn't a specific requirement in the standards that access be provided to the primary entrance, but certainly with courthouses where certain entrances dominate, and they're usually where most outside traffic is directed to, it's really important that that entrance be accessible if you want to achieve good access. And door automation of exterior doors is also very helpful because doors to courthouses can be heavy, they can be large, they can be ornate, and automating exterior doors is very helpful for access. Right now, under the standards, exterior doors are not required to meet the maximum 5 pounds opening force, but we advise that it's a good idea to automate doors. And automation of an exterior door is required for federal courthouses under standards governing federal courthouses. So that is actually required in that case. Slide 14. Now, with entrances and designs that involve raised plinths, we see that usually the accessible route is greatly complicated. And here on this slide, you actually see an image of a courthouse, federal courthouse in Eugene, Oregon, that was built some years ago. And this design features a lot of steps up to the entry level. The original design, as it was built, actually had the accessible entrance on a lower level, not the primary level. And it was actually a source of contention locally among groups who actually filed complaints about it. And the General Services Administration did have some changes made to provide access to the primary entrance on the main level. But in order to do that, they had to provide a ramp. And the yellow arrow there is actually tracing the route of the ramp, which you could see is quite long because it's spanning a significant change in elevation. And this may be more of an extreme case, but even if the entry level isn't raised as high as this, the necessary ramp and length and the need for switchback and a significant upslope travel distance greatly compromise usability. So it's really beneficial in the design of courthouses to minimize the elevation of the entry level. Slide 15. Now, as I mentioned, automation of exterior doors is highly recommended, but if you're dealing with a federal courthouse, automation of an exterior door is required by GSA's public building standards. Other courthouses, state and local courthouses, county courthouses covered by the ADA and the ADA standards do not have such a mandate, but we strongly encourage door automation. Slide 16. And that's also important in providing an accessible route to entrances that bollards and other security barriers not obstruct the accessible route. You need at least one accessible route serving each accessible entrance. And so if you do have anything like bollards or other elements to enhance security, then it's important that you preserve an accessible route, which continuously has to be at least 3 feet wide, but can reduce to 32 inches at a point so that access isn't obstructed. Slide 17. Now, the standards also address routes around security screening device, a typical feature of courtrooms for security. And since a lot of metal screening devices can accommodate many mobility aids, wheeled mobility aids, typically the only solution is to provide an alternative route around the device, and this is permitted and addressed by the standards. Slide 18. With respect to restricted entrances where you may have a communication device to gain entry into the facility, the standards require that it operate with visual and audible signals so that the system is accessible to people with hearing impairments and people who may have vision impairments. This is required in Section 230 of the standards, and it's applying where provided. Slide 19. At entrances that serve detainees and inmates, the standards do have exceptions if manual doors are provided that are operated only by security personnel. This is unique to this kind of environment and the situation where a type of door is going to be operated by someone else. In this case, we do permit departures from the requirements for hardware, the closing speed, and the opening force of manual doors. Other requirements for doors for that one secured entrance required to be accessible must be met. But the provisions for hardware closing speed and opening force do not. Now, if the door is automated, then the only requirements that one has to meet are those concerning the clear width and those addressing thresholds. Slide 20. Now we're going to move on into expanding requirements that apply to the courtroom itself. And we're going to start out with scoping of courtrooms, address courtroom entrances, and then move into the various courthouse courtroom spaces and how access to them can be provided. Slide 21. Now, courtroom scoping, which is addressed in Section 231, is requiring that in new construction, all courtrooms be accessible. You're not allowed to just have a portion be accessible in new construction. It's all of them. Again, this is pointing to the fact that access that is designed and built in is much easier, much more cost effective. So we want full access in new construction. In the case of altered courthouses, the requirements apply to each courtroom that is altered. And the requirements are going to apply according to the scope of work, which is pretty much how the standards work in any kind of alteration. How extensive the work is going to determine how much of the standards are triggered. So the number of courtrooms affected by an alteration and the degree to which they're altered are going to determine what is triggered in the standards. And as I noted earlier, if you have a house that's existing, meaning it predates the ADA and thus wasn't subject to the standards in full and is not being altered, then one has to rely on their obligation for program access. And program access very well can necessitate retrofits to achieve access to the goods, the service, the programs available by a state or local government entity. So usually in this situation, it's a matter of looking at the facility and seeing what is needed so that the court system in all its phases and aspects accommodates people with disabilities. That would include not only people that are a party to a jury or a court action or proceeding, but it would also include witnesses, jurors, spectators, and so forth. So it's important to look at all aspects of court programs and services in meeting your program access responsibilities. Slide 22. Now, with respect to courtrooms, what we're going to be looking at today are the entrance areas, including the doors and signage. We're going to be talking about the gallery seating and components within the well of the court, such as the litigant tables and lecterns, jury box, witness stand, gates, and the judge's bench, clerk stations, and other workstations. Slide 23. Now, with courtroom entrances, the doors must be fully compliant with the provisions found in Section 404. Unlike exterior doors, interior doors and those to a courtroom have to meet the 5 pounds maximum opening force. And sometimes in certain designs, the type of door is such that it may, by its weight and dimensions, be heavy to open. But the 5 pound opening force requirement must be met in the case of interior doors that are on an accessible route. If you can't meet the 5 pound force requirement, the door has to be automated. Slide 24. Now, where doors are automated, the standards provide criteria for the type of door that's automated. They reference industry standards, and they include a new provision that ensures that the clear floor space at a control for an automated door, like a push plate, be located outside the door swing. This is required so that one doesn't hurry up and have to get out of the way as the door begins to open. Slide 25. Another requirement for doors in the standards is the minimum 4 foot separation between the swing of doors. And this applies no matter which direction the doors swing. They both swing in the same direction, or both swing out or in, you must have a 4 foot separation between them minimum. This helps ensure space for people using wheel mobility aids to clear the swing of one door before encountering the next. So a lot of courtrooms are designed with an entry vestibule and prison series, so it's important to keep this minimum separation in mind. Slide 26. Now, signage is often provided at courtrooms, labeling the courtroom and providing, related information. Now, the courtroom number and the labels must be visual and tactile because the standards require permanent room labels, and this would be, a courtroom would be considered a permanent room space, to provide access to both people with vision impairments, whether it's low vision or no vision. So they have to be visually accessible and have the raised characters in Braille. Now, visual and tactile access is also required for other types of signs, namely room numbers, labels for other permanent rooms, including restrooms, and this would be labels at the entry to the room. Exits and floor levels. These are the type of signs that must be raised and brailled in addition to being visually legible. Slide 27. Now, there's many other types of courtroom signage that does not have to be tactile. If signs that provide directional or information, such as rules of conduct sign, an example being maybe signs prohibiting cell phone use within a space. These types of signs have to comply with the standards for visual access, but they're not required to have the raised characters or braille. And some signs, like occupant names, building names, signs that are temporary, they don't have to comply at all. Now, when we say occupant names, we do mean individuals' names, so that signs in a courtroom that indicate who the presiding judge is, for example, that would actually be considered exempt under the standards. But one could still meet the requirements for visual access as a best practice, but that wouldn't be required. Slide 28. Moving on from entrances and signage, we're going to talk now about gallery seating, the spectator area within courtrooms that must provide accessible seating for as wheelchair spaces. Slide 29. Now, the standards require a minimum number of wheelchair spaces in assembly areas. This is found in section 221, and it's scoped according to the total seating capacity. Now, for spaces with 4 to 25 seats, you must have at least one accessible seating space. For 26 to 50, you need two. And from 51 to 150, you need at least four. Most spectator areas within a courtroom are going to fall within one of these categories, and that's what's required to be provided. Now, with the case of courtrooms and bench seating, whatever formulation you could use to determine the amount, the seating capacity, is what you would use to then determine the minimum number of spaces required. Slide 30. Here in this slide, we see in plan view wheelchair spaces located in the gallery area, located off the center aisle, which is often where they're provided. Now, it's important that the wheelchair space be located within the seating footprint. It's important, too, that the wheelchair space not overlap aisle or circulation paths, so they must be located off the center aisle. Usually, though, they are provided, as seen here, with a side approach into the space as opposed to some other location. Slide 31. Now, the size of wheelchair seating spaces is based on which way you approach and enter the space. If you have entry from either the front or the back, the space must be at least 36 inches wide and at least 48 inches long. If you enter from the side, we require greater depth, 60 inches minimum. This is required to accommodate the right angle turn one needs to make to properly enter and position within that space. These and other requirements for accessible wheelchair spaces are found in section 802 of the standards. Slide 32. Now, it's also required that your wheelchair space be located to allow shoulder-to-shoulder alignment with adjacent seating, including companion seating. Now, in addressing this, the standards indicate that the alignment is to occur as measured 36 inches from the leading edge of the wheelchair space, which is corresponding more or less with the torso center line. So you want to make sure that that space is positioned at adjacent seating to allow that kind of alignment. Slide 33. Another feature of courtrooms, this one in vicinity of the gallery seating area, are gates. And we recommend, consistent with our advisory committee's guidance, that no gates be used. this provides easier access. And gates don't really provide much typically in the way of security. They're more of an aesthetic feature or a psychological one of to enhance separation of the well of the court, maybe enhance some formality of the space. But aside from that, there's, to our knowledge, not many strong reasons for a gate. And if you avoid gates, then you allow for easier access. Slide 34. Now, if you do provide gates, they must comply with our section in the standards covering doors and gates, section 404. This would include one active leaf having a clear width of at least 32 inches. We also require a smooth surface on the push side. Now, the standards say that the smooth surface is at the bottom 10 inches of the surface, measured from above the floor. That's not requiring that your gate go down to that to the floor, but that smooth surface provision is applying where the gate does extend that far. If it doesn't, then it doesn't really apply. Gates also must have an opening force of 5 pounds maximum, just like interior swing doors. And the closing speed is also addressed, and it must be at least 1.5 seconds closing speed measured from an open position of 70 degrees to a closed position. And the hardware, if any is provided, must also be compliant with our specifications. Slide 35. We're going to talk a little bit now about the jury box and witness stand. And here we want to give you an overview of what some of the key requirements are. Now, in these spaces, you must have a clear floor space to accommodate wheeled mobility aids within the defined area of the jury box and the witness stand. Now, removable seats can overlap these spaces when not needed for access. Gates or enclosures to these spaces can't inhibit unassisted access. That's another important requirement. If either of these areas are raised, they must be have a ramp or lift access, and this kind of access must be permanent. Portable solutions like fold-out ramps, telescoping ramps, portable lifts, they are not permitted to provide vertical access to either the jury box or witness stand, at least not new construction. In the case of existing facilities, including historic facilities, where maybe there is a problem, a constraint you're running into with a permanent solution, temporary alternatives may be viable, but it's not an option in new construction. And it's also important that if you have a space that is raised and served by a ramp, that you have turning space within it. This is true for the jury box, it's true for the witness stand. This is important because the turning space is providing room so that to ensure that a person doesn't have to back down a ramp, that they have to turn around on the raised area to approach and exit through the ramp in a forward manner. So that's important to remember in dealing with areas served by a ramp. Slide 36. Now, the clear floor space requirement is very similar but slightly different than the ones we saw for the wheelchair spaces in the gallery seating. Here, in the case of jury boxes and witness stands, we're really referencing the basic clear floor space requirement that is also used for clear floor space at Elements generally. Now, this space must be at least 30 inches wide and 48 inches deep. And if the space is obstructed on both sides more than half the depth or more than 24 inches, then it has to be 36 inches wide instead of 30. This is to provide more space for maneuvering and sway when entering or exiting the space. But if the space is not confined on both sides, you can go with the 30-inch minimum clear width. Slide 37. Now for a side approach into clear floor space, a greater depth of 6 inches minimum is required when the front and back are obstructed more than half the width, or 15 inches. This is similar to what we saw with the assembly wheelchair space. When you need to make a turn into a space, we add a foot of space to the 48 for a total of 60 inches to accommodate that necessary maneuvering. Next slide. And if you have any kind of counter work surface overlapping the clear floor space, that's permitted, but the clearance below must be at least 27 inches high to provide adequate room for knees and toes. And the overlap is, in terms of the depth, the overlap is limited to 25 inches max in terms of measured from the front of the clear floor space in. Next slide. Now, there are some exceptions for alterations in existing courthouses. And as I pointed out, the wheelchair space required for the jury box and witness stand must be located within the defined area. But if you are dealing with an alteration to an existing courtroom and the necessary ramp or lift to provide access to such a space would obstruct a means of egress and pose a hazard, that's one condition where the standards would permit you to locate the wheelchair space outside the defined area, but it's limited only to that condition. In the case of historic facilities, other departures may be viable where compliance would impact the historic integrity of the facility, because in the standards, there's provisions that recognize the historic preservation, and in a qualified historic facility, any compliance with standards that would be demonstrated to impact the historic integrity can be the basis for departures. Slide 40. Now here we're looking in plan view at a jury box, and this is one where the first row is at floor level. And this is the easiest way to provide access to a jury box, is by keeping the first row at floor level, obviating the need for a ramp or lift. If it's entered from the side, as you see here, again, you have that 60-inch minimum depth front to back for the space to allow easy maneuvering into the space. Slide 41. Now, if the first tier is raised, a ramp can serve to provide access or a lift. And in this case, you do need the turning space available so that one could exit properly from the space on the ramp. Slide 42. Now, this turning space can overlap the wheelchair space. It's one thing that can help minimize space impacts. Typically, you're going to have room for turning at the top of the ramp because of the required landing that must be provided. And we'll look at more of that in a minute. Slide 43. I just want to point out here, too, that when we're talking about turning space, we're talking about one of two options. The 60-inch diameter circle, which is what you see most often in designs, but you also have the option of a T-shaped space that's basically a 3-foot wide T with overall dimensions in length and width of 5 feet. Either one can be used. In some situations, the T-shaped space might help minimize space impacts, but you could use either one. Slide 44. Now with ramps, the basic requirements in Section 405 of the standards apply. The courtroom ramps are treated no differently. You must have 5-foot landings at both the top and bottom of the ramp, and they must be as wide as the ramp. The ramp itself has to be at least 36 inches wide, measured between handrails. The slope, of course, has to be 1 to 12 maximum. Edge protection is required, too, so that it's not a hazard for anyone going over the edge. And handrails are required on both sides if the rise is greater than 6 inches. A lot of ramps that serve areas in a courtroom raise only one step often don't have to have the dual handrails because the rise is not exceeding 6 inches. But even if you don't have to have the handrails, you still have to have edge protection. Slide 45. Now with jury boxes, the clear floor space is sometimes provided for front entry, as you see here, especially where the first tier is at floor level. Now this space is one where it really requires backing in. I think some people become interested in this option because it requires only 48 inches of depth instead of the 60 inches. But often, in order to enclose a space means having that section of millwork in front of the space function as a gate as well. And this often can impact usability. Slide 46. Here's a photo of this type of situation. Now the gates often don't provide unassisted entry. They're often heavy because they have the millwork of the enclosure, and they would still have to meet the 5-pound maximum opening force if you provide them. It's also difficult to get to manually close it once you've entered the space. I mean, once a person using a wheelchair backs into the space, it sometimes is a challenge to get that closed behind you. And so this is why we prefer side entry instead of the front entry for jury box wheelchair space. Slide 47. This is just giving you another example of the front entry wheelchair space in a jury box. There you see that on the right-hand side, the gate is in the open position, and if one were to wheel into that space, it can be somewhat difficult, awkward to try and close it behind them. Slide 48. Now we're going to talk a bit about witness stands, which by and large are treated the same way as the jury box was. With witness stands, if floor level is viable, that's the easiest way to provide access. Sometimes under some design considerations, this is not an option. And where it's raised, slide 49, we recommend that ramp access be provided instead of lift access. Either one is permitted, but ramps are the preferred means of access to the witness stand as well as the jury box. Slide 50. Now, the space required within the witness stand is similar to that of a jury box. If you have a side entry, it has to be at least 60 inches deep and at least 30 inches wide, or 36 if the depth is confined significantly. And next slide. Wheelchair space, if the area is served by ramp, has to be provided. And then, as indicated with the jury box, the turning space can overlap partially the wheelchair space. Here you see in this image, too, that an overlapping counter of the space is required to provide the minimum knee and toe clearance. Slide 52. And this slide is just showing the T-shaped alternative, which can be provided in lieu of the 60-inch diameter circle. Slide 53. So I just would like to talk a little bit now about ramps versus lifts. We recommend ramps instead of lifts because they're preferred by most users. Ramps are more reliably allowing unassisted use, independent access. They're less conspicuous. They're more reliable, and they don't involve all the maintenance responsibilities and considerations you have with lifts. So these are the primary reasons why ramps are generally preferred over lifts. Slide 54. Now, where lifts are used, there are some key considerations, particularly in courtrooms. Courtroom design is such that there's really no one standard template for courtroom lifts. They're pretty much required to be custom designed into the space. It's also important that the architectural finishes and the millwork be closely coordinated with the platform and enclosure details. We've seen a lot of problems in the past where a lack of coordination in both these design elements have led to problems, have led to costly changes in the lift installation, the millwork. It's also important that lifts operate in a way to allow unassisted operation. Now, we do permit certain features, like, for example, a lot of times a movable chair has to be moved out of a witness stand. That's okay because that's really not tied to lift operation. But we want the lift and the features of the lift to allow unassisted operation. It's also important to factor in the maintenance and repair that's often necessary in the use of lifts. And the new standards in Section 410 are also requiring compliance with the industry standard, the ASME A18.1 standard. Slide 55. Now, the reference industry standard has a section on courtroom lifts beginning with the 2008 edition. As does the most recent 2011 edition. I do want to point out that these later editions of 2008, 2011 are not yet referenced by the ADA and ABA standards. They reference the 99 and 2003 edition, which do not contain a section specifically on courtroom lifts. And this has been a helpful addition to the industry standards, because courtroom lifts have different requirements and considerations than most other lifts, which are typically just functioning as part of a route. Courtroom lifts are not really doing that. They're really just helping modify a particular space and bringing it down in lift fashion. And so the considerations, the design factors are a bit different. For example, in the past, hydraulic or scissor lifts were found to be more problematic in courtroom installations because the courtroom lift, in many situations, that is, say, integrated into a witness stand, is really doing double duty as maintaining a platform in a raised position. And so there are different functional performance considerations with courtroom lifts when they are being used this way. And with hydraulic lifts, there were problems with deflection and the platform not staying in the position it needed to over time. That led to complaints and issues about adequate access. and reliability. But we see with this later edition of the code that the section on courtroom lists is really geared towards addressing these issues and providing requirements that allow for more satisfactory operation of a lift in this kind of setting. Slide 56. And certain different types of lift drive systems that can be used typically in a courtroom installation include the cantilevered platform, screw drive lift, an electric scissor lift, or a four-cornered screw drive lift. And these type of drive systems are really helping make sure that to prevent deflection of the platform and satisfactory operation. Slide 55. In these next few slides, I want to just kind of give you a sense of how some lift solutions work. Here in this slide, we're seeing the lift in the normal position when the space is used as a witness stand at the standard level for use as a witness stand. Slide 58 is showing you that this lift has, the platform has lowered, the doors are closed, and there's a roll of barrier in the front there noted that comes activates when the lift is being used. A reason for this barrier is the fact that the platform size under the ASME code is limited to 25 square feet. So if you have a witness stand area that's going to exceed that, you need a barrier type of device to close off the space to meet that 25 square foot maximum platform size. Slide 59. Here with the platform closer to the floor level, it deploys an automated step ramp entry system. The door is open, allowing for entry into the lift. Slide 60. Here the ramp is in travel. It could serve the witness stand or in slide 61. It can also extend up to the level to serve the judge's bench. We don't require that the lift serve both levels. It's been done to save space, but different options, solutions are possible. Slide 62. These slides are just giving you some photo images of the design we just looked at. Here's the view of the witness stand with the lift in position for standard use for witnesses. Slide 63. This is a view from within the witness stand looking to where the roll up barrier would be stowed. This is in the down position, and it corresponds to the ledge or counter of the witness stand. Slide 64. And here you see the same area with the roll up barrier extended. This is what's occurring when the lift is in use. Slide 65. So in the use of platform lifts, we have some key recommendations. It's important, very important, to coordinate the millwork and the lift design. In fact, it's essential if you really want everything to work properly as intended. It's also a good idea to establish minimum warranty requirements, and also in contract documents require ensure local regional service and parts availability, because in the past one of the problems reported too was that and I think the General Services Administration and federal courthouses ran into this problem, was that with lift installations there was difficulty in getting the necessary servicing or repair due to the lack of local services available. Slide 66. Now I'd like to talk a bit about the workstations of a courtroom, including judges' benches. There are some differences here with how these areas are addressed as opposed to the jury box and witness stand. The jury box the witness stand, we require to be fully accessible because it's accommodating different types of people, almost like public space. But workstations, work areas, we do allow some departures in light of the fact that these areas serve a discrete group of people and typically in an employee situation where certain accommodations can be made more readily and realistically with the necessary notice. We require for these spaces that they have the clear floor space, including the in-tow space below work surfaces. Work surfaces must be at an accessible height that's 28 to 34 inches high above the floor. And vertical access by ramp or lift is required, or it could be added as an adaptable feature. And actually, this is the one area in the standards where we basically permit vertical access to be adaptable. Slide 67. Now, if the ramp or lift is installed after construction, it must provide the necessary space and the electrical service, in the case of a lift, as part of design. So you don't have to have the ramp installed or the lift, but the space, the power supply, that has to be there ready to facilitate later installation. Now, this adaptable access is not permitted for the jury box or witness stand. And it's important, too, to note that the International Building Code does have a similar provision in its 2009 edition, but not earlier editions. So if you're in a jurisdiction where you're subject to the IBC, be alert that if it's an edition before 2009, you may not be permitted to follow this adaptable allowance under the IBC. Also, state and local requirements may be stricter than the ADA standards on this point. So that's another important thing to verify, because when you're complying with all necessary requirements, the ADA standards don't trump any state or local requirements. Both have to be met. And where there's a difference, the stricter one is always governing as a practical matter. So with the case of state and local requirements or jurisdictions that are applying an edition of the International Building Code, be sure to determine whether or not any of those relevant documents are going to permit the vertical axis to be adaptable, like the ADA standards do. Slide 68. Now, even though that's permitted, we would recommend as a best practice that vertical axis be provided built in as part of construction, as opposed to being provided later. We would either say that this should be done in all courtrooms as a best practice. That way, one does not have to worry about later installation of the necessary ramp or lift based on need. The other option would be to have full built-in access in some, maybe one of each type of courtroom, and have the remainder offer adaptable access. So that could be another way of providing good access. Slide 69. Now, looking more specifically at the judge's bench, we recommend that a ramp be used instead of a lift, that it be built in as part of construction. And we also recommend that it be located outside the courtroom. This is something that our advisory committee strongly encouraged. And the reason for location outside the courtroom is it does enhance security and decorum. If you have a ramp or lift right immediately off the well of the court within the space, it's not as safe for a judge where maybe there's some kind of incident or threat occurring in order to get away from the hazard. If you have a ramp located off outside the room within a secure corridor, you're actually enhancing the safety of the judge. Slide 70. Here we see an example of a ramp that's located behind a wall in the courtroom. So it's still in the courtroom, but it's behind a wall, and it enhances security and decorum. Slide 71. And here, this is a plan view of the same feature, it's the same courtroom, where you see that it's has a switchback ramp there that proceeds to the judge's bench and connects all the way down to the floor level of the secured corridor. Slide 72. This slide is showing you examples of a lift solution located behind a wall that's also better than a lift located with in the open area of the courtroom. And it too, like the ramp, provides greater security and decorum, not being visible from within the courtroom. Slide 73. Now this is a plan view of a sample courtroom that incorporates the requirements as well as the best practice recommendations I've been talking about. If we look kind of working our way from the left-hand side, the entry vestibule, you see that there we have the necessary 4-foot separation between the swing of doors. And then entering the courtroom in the gallery seating area, we have the wheelchair space seating within the footprint available as required. The jury box here in this and the witness stand in this design are raised, the first tier of the jury box is raised 6 inches, as is the witness stand, and that's served by one ramp. So it's certainly acceptable to have one ramp serve both spaces if they're at the same elevation, as you see here. Then over it, looking up in the upper right-hand corner, you see a clerk station and court reporters located in front of the judge's bench that are on a 6-inch riser or platform, and that too is served by a ramp. Note how these areas that are raised, served by ramp, have the necessary turning space. At the judge's bench, which is raised 18 inches above the floor, access is provided by ramp, and this ramp is located within the secured corridor. So this type of design, which is really based on a standard federal district courtroom of 2,400 square feet, incorporates accessibility with little to no space impacts. Slide 74. Now, federal courtrooms tend to be larger than state and local courtrooms, and this plan is in a similar fashion showing how the requirements can be met. But here we're looking at a courtroom of 1,800 square feet in size. Again, we see at the entry vestibule on the left-hand side the separation between the swing of doors and the gallery area, the wheelchair spaces. This is, again, assuming that the seating capacity is such that 4 spaces are triggered. We have in the jury box the first tier at floor level, so there's no need for a ramp at the jury box. At the witness stand, which is raised 6 inches, you do have a dedicated ramp. You have the requisite turning space in the witness stand along with the wheelchair space. And you have a similar situation on the other side serving the clerk station, which is also raised 6 inches. This design, too, is showing you the ramp to the judge's bench being located in the secured corridor. And that design has great benefits. Now, as we mentioned earlier, under the adaptability allowance, that ramp serving the judge's bench in the secured corridor could be installed after construction as needed if one wanted. but you would still have to size that corridor appropriately in order to make room for the ramp as part of design and construction. And I'd like to talk about a couple other elements within courtrooms we didn't get to yet. Slide 75, like lecterns. Lecterns, we require compliance where they're fixed or built in, and few are in most courtrooms. But whether they're, if they're not fixed, we still have some recommendations that allow for enhanced accessibility. Slide 76. If a lectern is provided, key things to providing good access is that it have an adjustable surface, and a surface that goes down to 28 inches, which is the minimum height for an accessible surface. And if it goes up to a height of approximately 44 inches, then you're also going to adequately accommodate people who are standing. It's also a good idea that the angle of the surface be adjustable, and two, that the top edge be adjustable with the surface, so that you're preserving an adequate line of sight even when you have it lowered. If that top edge doesn't lower as well, then often the sight lines for someone seated at the lectern using it at a lower surface can be compromised. And of course, for good wheelchair accessibility, you want the knee and toe space being provided under the work surface. This would have to be at least 27 inches high and at least 17 inches deep. Slide 77. Another important component of courthouse accessibility is the provision of assistive listening systems. These are technologies that facilitate access for people with limited hearing or who are hard of hearing. They're not going to accommodate people who are deaf or with very significant hearing loss. Assistive listening systems basically improve the sound signal of an audio amplification system. And so they're only going to benefit people with some residual hearing. They're required in each courtroom. This can be found in Section 219 of the standards. The technologies types for these systems include infrared, which is the most common type used in courtrooms because it offers greater confidentiality than FM systems, which can bleed through walls. You could also have a loop system wired that has some benefits because the loop system is a type that allows people with telecoil-equipped hearing aids to benefit from the system without any need for use of a receiver. Otherwise, receivers must be used, and the standards also address the number of receivers based on seating capacity, and they also require that a portion of receivers be compatible with hearing aids. And the standards also require that the posting of signs indicating the availability of these systems. Slide 78. This slide is showing you an example of a type of sign in one courtroom indicating that this listening system is available. I'd like to move on and talk a little bit about the holding cells. Next slide. And yes, slide 80. Holding cells. We require that whether your holding cells are located in a central location in the courthouse or if they're provided to immediately serve courtrooms, we require access to whichever type is provided. And if you segregate the population and have dedicated cells for based on whether they're serving male or female, adult or juvenile, that access be provided to at least one of each type. If the cells individually serve courtrooms or groups of courtrooms, at least one must be accessible per courtroom. And if an accessible cell can serve more than one courtroom, that's permitted. It's important, though, that cell access be available in conjunction with each courtroom. Slide 81. And the requirements for cells address doors, and the exceptions I noted earlier for entrances where the door is operated only by security personnel, they apply equally to interior doors serving cells. We also require turning space within accessible cells, and if benches are provided, we don't require them, but if they're provided, then it's also important to provide the wheelchair space available at the bench, as you see here. And the turning space and the wheelchair space can partially overlap. Slide 82. Now, we also require the toilet facilities serving a cell to be accessible. And this would include the height and location of the toilet fixture, grab bars in both the rear and sidewall, and lavatories. Now, a lot of situations, there's an interest in using a combination toilet and lavatory fixture. There are some models out there that are designed for accessibility. The combination unit can typically be used so long as all the other requirements are met, the dual grab bars on the back and side, the lavatory, the clearances, the space at the water closet not being obstructed by the lavatory itself. So if there is a combination unit that meets all those criteria, it should be okay under the standards. But we don't provide any exceptions from the requirements for toilets and lavatories in the case of a combination unit. Next slide. The standards also address visiting areas and require access to counters on both the visitor side and the detainee side. If you have security glazing, it's also important to provide a method to facilitate voice communication. And if it has a handset, then we require volume controls. Typically, where fixed seats are provided, the accessible location has to have either a movable or swing away type seat. And you see an example of that in this photo. Slide 84. Now, some other spaces in a courtroom I would just like to mention briefly is our jury assembly rooms, jury deliberation rooms. These spaces are subject to requirements in the standards. They're not specifically located in the section on courtrooms out in Chapter 8 of the standards, but jury assembly rooms, for example, are treated like any other assembly rooms. They're going to have their required number of wheelchair spaces, companion seating, and if they have audio amplification, they're going to be required to have an assistive listening system. With jury deliberation rooms, what I would like to note is that certain elements, where provided, must be accessible. Sometimes there may be kitchenettes provided to serve jurors in deliberations. And one of the questions we got in advance was about the sinks of kitchenettes and asking whether they could provide a side approach. Under the new standards, kitchen sinks located in a room without a cooktop or range can provide a side approach access instead of forward approach. So yes, that would be permitted. With judges' suites too, it's important that full access be provided to accommodate any kind of public traffic, visitor traffic. It's likely that maybe certain features or individual elements used by justices might be addressed when the need arises for access. But you know, doors, accessible routes, approach for entry and exit. You want design and construction to achieve that type of access. And restrooms in court facilities are treated like all other facilities. All public and common use restrooms must be accessible. The only allowance is if you have a toilet room or bathing facility serving their particular occupant, a private one serving a particular occupant located off an individual's workspace. We do allow some adaptable features like grab bars to be provided later, but the room and the space requirements must be met as part of design and construction. So at this point, I'd like to just turn to any questions that may have come in.
Okay.
During this session.
Okay, Dave. One question that we received is, if operated by guards, do doors between courtrooms and holding cells, are they still required to be accessible if they're operated by the guard?
Yes. The doors have to be accessible, but they are permitted exceptions from certain requirements. They're not required to meet the hardware requirements, or the closing speed, or the opening force. But clear width, thresholds, maneuvering clearance, they still have to be met.
Okay. Another is, when there's a single step into the jury box, is that considered a stair and does it need handrail?
That type of requirement is best addressed under applicable building codes. The standards do address stairways that are part of a means of egress, but we generally look to the applicable building code in terms of any requirements related to steps and stairs.
And well, in answering that, I'll just go along with, because Dave mentioned means of egress, and we had a question about slide 39, and someone was asking, what did MOE stand for on that slide? And that is what it stands for, the means of egress. Another question you had is to define architectural plinths. That term was used on one of the slides.
Yeah, that's a term related to a raised platform typically associated with the entrance of a building. Usually what you see in a lot of older style courthouses, kind of like a pediment.
Okay. Another question is, with courtroom signage, if it is required to be tactile, why is it allowed to be at a height of 60 inches when the reach range is 48?
The tactile sign requirements say that the raised letters in Braille must be located, and this is measured to the baseline, within a height of 48 inches to 60 inches from the floor. It's a good idea, as the question points out, to try and keep it closer to the 48 for access from a seated position, but we also have to balance this with the interest people have in being able to comfortably read signage tactily in a standing position. So that's why we do allow the signage placement to be within 48 to 60 inches to accommodate people who are standing as well.
We had a question on slide 25, and it's back to the handrails, and it said, are handrails required at a jury box that is tiered 3 or more and has a central aisle similar to bleachers, because slide 25 did not appear to have rails? And while Dave is looking at that one, we also had a question because he'd spoken about automatic door openers in GSA's directive, and so we had a question, does this apply to all federal buildings or is it just federal courthouses? It applies to all facilities that are owned or leased by GSA. It's a GSA regulation. So if there's an ABA facility that's a different agency, that is not applicable. It's only for GSA.
Yes, the public building standards by GSA only apply to buildings that GSA oversees. So it's not limited to federal courthouses, but like other federal buildings, federal office buildings built, designed, overseen by GSA are typically covered by that public building standard. But non-GSA buildings are not covered by it, and that requirement for automation is found only in that public building standard.
Okay, did you find slide 25?
Yeah, can you repeat the question?
Yes, the question for 25. Are handrails required at a jury box that is tiered 3 or more and has a central aisle similar to bleachers? Slide 25 did not appear to have handrails. Okay. Well,
generally, that's not required because the box is usually not raised that high, so I'm not sure the particular situation.
Okay. Another question, when are wheelchair lifts in courtrooms acceptable? Are there solutions that begin to address the concerns or problems? When are wheelchair lifts in courtrooms acceptable?
Well, lifts can be used in any courtroom to provide access to the jury box, the witness stand, the judge's bench, and other raised workstations like clerk stations. They're permitted. We recommend, as a best practice, ramps instead of lifts, or wherever viable, that you not raise the space. Like, for example, in a jury box, when it's possible to have the first tier at floor level, you know, go with it, and then avoid the need for any ramp or lift to serve that area.
Okay, we have another question. If a courthouse is being remodeled, must holding cells be updated?
If a courthouse is being remodeled, it really depends on whether the work is impacting existing holding cells. And there's two things to consider here, and this is true really for any alteration, is that by and large, the standards require you to comply where you are altering elements and spaces. Those spaces, elements affected by an alteration are subject to the standards. If there's a particular area not affected by your alteration, then it's not required to comply. The only scenario where you may have to go outside your planned scope of work is when you alter an area containing a primary function. A courtroom would be a primary function area. In that case, you have to address a accessible path of travel to it, including the restrooms, phones, and drinking fountains serving that area. But if your work is not affecting holding cells, then generally you're not required to address that as part of your alteration. But keep in mind that even if you do an alteration and you're not required to do certain things because in light of the scope of work, state and local government entities still have an obligation to provide program access, and that's true no matter whether you alter or not. So even though you may not have a specific requirement as part of your alteration, you still have a responsibility to have the program operate in a way so that it accommodates people with disabilities, including detainees with disabilities.
Okay, we had a question about the assistive listening systems, and does this apply only in new construction or is it in alterations also?
The requirement for assistive listening systems applies in new construction, and it would also apply in alterations affecting assembly areas or involving audio amplification systems. Usually in the case of an alteration, there are types of units that would probably be easier to install after construction that can be used.
Okay. Okay, well, we have time for one more question, and then we're going to have to end our session for today. And we have a question, is a lift allowed at the main entrance of the building in lieu of a ramp?
Good question. Generally, no. Outside of courtrooms and jury boxes and judges' benches, the standards strictly limit the use of lifts for some of the reasons I outlined, you know, reliability, ease of use, et cetera. And for entrances, exterior entrances, you really can't use a lift except in certain unique situations where a ramp is not feasible. Maybe like, for example, with a project at an existing facility where you don't have the space for for a ramp where it would impact or encroach on other things such as the right-of-way. There's only certain situations, unique constraints that would possibly allow one to go with a lift in providing access to an entrance, but it really doesn't extend to new construction.
Okay, that's all the time that we have today. The slide that you're looking at now does show the contact information for the Access Board. We do realize we were not able to get to everyone's questions today, but feel free to actually call on our TA line to follow up with any questions or send email to our technical assistance box at ta@accessboard.gov, and we'll be happy to answer those questions for you. And just wanted to remind everyone and invite you to please join us for our next webinar, which is the 2010 ADA Standards for Accessible Design, that will be held on March 1st, 2012. And now I'm going to turn it back over to Robin. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you, Arlene, and thank you, Dave, for a very informative session. Lots of information, lots of slides, and I know there were many questions, as you indicated, so people hopefully will follow up and contact you. Just a reminder that this session is being recorded, and so you will be able to access the recording of this session for review within the next day on our website under the archive section, as all of the sessions that are held as part of this series are available for review, past sessions, including the handouts for download or printing if you so desire. To disconnect from today's session, you can just close your browser. There is also a little icon at the lower left-hand corner that looks like two plugs coming together. If you just click on that, that will also disconnect you from the session. Again, thank you one and all for your participation, and I hope you have a great rest of your day. Thank you.